a hospitalization can be an incredibly lonely experience, a very isolating experience for weeks on end. And that was a really tough occurrence. And when I was, you know, after my hospitalization in March and leaving Johns Hopkins in June, I was itching to get back into Washington, get back to work, be a productive citizen again, and find some sense of normalcy. And I was able to do that through the months of June and July in 2017. Although I was significantly weaker and thinner, and as my immune system was still very fragile, sure. I was taking all sorts of precautions. I had to be very careful. I couldn't live as robust a lifestyle as I had prior to my hospitalization. But I was making great progress, and I was happy to be a productive member of society again. And all of a sudden, at the end of July, having that come to a screeching halt and realizing that my transplant had failed me and that I was going to be relapsing again, and that the only way for me to find normalcy again was to then go through another bone marrow transplant, was absolutely soul-crushing.
Anirudh Srirangam, my guest for this episode, has lived through experiences that most of us cannot even fathom. At just 25 years old in 2017, Anirudh was diagnosed with a rare blood disease that threatened to derail his life. He fought through this disease not just once, but twice, requiring two bone marrow transplants before his recovery began. As a rising star in the healthcare policy field, and having gone through such a trying, life-changing experience himself, Anirudh is just one of the most knowledgeable people about healthcare in America. I was so excited to chat with Anirudh about his incredible story, as well as pick his thoughts on the developments in healthcare and the policy frameworks within America. Just a quick note to any of my listeners that have ever had to go through a difficult health experience or a health scare. The first half of this podcast is essentially Anirudh describing his diagnosis as well as his process of battling this rare blood disease. So if you might be triggered by that, I would highly advise you to avoid that first section. We then go on to discuss the healthcare policy aspects, which I'm sure you will find interesting. This is Millennial Musings with Anurag. Thank you for tuning in. Anirudh, my man, thank you so much for joining in. It's crazy, but I'm seeing you after 2015. And although I've been able to keep in touch via social media, this is awesome. Thanks for doing this.
Absolutely, man. I've been keeping a keen eye on your path as well and all of your great successes. It's such a pleasure to finally catch up. I was just thinking about our time together in Washington and what really draws me to that city in the first place. Yeah. And I think it's people like you. I think it's people from diverse backgrounds that come to DC with the singular mission of trying to contribute towards civic service. When I identified people like you and got to meet others like yourselves, it reminds me of what I really love about Washington. I know there's so much to dislike about it in our current discourse, but this is really the best of Washington.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And I think we met through a mutual friend, and shout out to our buddy Narayan, who also featured on the first ever episode of Millennial Musing. So he's a special guest who's also been one of our biggest supporters. So I want to take us back to the last time we met, because it's kind of relevant to a lot of the things that we're going to be discussing right now. Last time we met, it was Narayan's farewell. We all sat together. Most of us at that point working in policy or kind of extensions of policy, I would say, at that point. Let's start from there and all these different trajectories our lives have taken. But one of the biggest things that at least struck me in the time since then was when I saw this article that you posted, which was one, heartbreaking, but at the same time also so eye-opening in many ways. I don't think I'd be doing justice if I talk about it myself. I'd love for you to give us a brief into that, what that article was about, what your experience was about, and then we can take it from there.
I appreciate that, and I think, you know, before I jump in, I think it's not heartbreaking for me, but it could potentially be heartbreaking for tens of thousands of others in our American healthcare system that don't have the access to high quality care that I was able to have throughout the course of 2017. So not heartbreaking for me, really a success story and a story that kind of speaks volumes about the good that can be done in our really high quality healthcare system but portends potentially poorly for people that don't have that, that access. So, you know, I think 2016, 2017 were interesting years in my early professional life. 2016, I had just come off of quite a few big professional successes. I had really began to cut my teeth at a life sciences government relations firm and been able to really carve out an area for myself as someone that really understood policy as it pertains to the biopharmaceutical industry and really had a passion for that. And I was also, in terms of personal growth, a really big year for me as well. Got a chance to run and finish two different marathons. And
amazing.
From someone that had never, for someone who had never really taken care of his body, really began to really dedicate myself to that, thanks to some mentors and colleagues that inspired me to do so. So it came as a shock to me in early 2017, where I would try and go for a routine run around my block and find myself totally winded. I would do really routine tasks like get out of the shower, you know, dry myself and try and put my pants on, and find that I was exasperated and couldn't finish doing a routine task. And that became kind of scary, but I think I fell into a certain kind of modus operandi that many of us, particularly young people that are accustomed to having good health through their lives, fall into, which is that even if you know your body well, even if you understand healthcare, if you understand life sciences, you can find yourself saying, ah, I've just got a cold. Ah, that tickle in my throat is nothing. Why am I feeling so tired today? I'm sure it's just because I haven't slept, haven't had enough coffee. And what happened to me over the course of March is that I had these pounding bilateral headaches on both sides of my skull, and I was ignoring it. I had a big trip planned with my current fiance to Peru. Knew I needed to get there, and so I kind of shoved that to the corner and said, you know what, it's not going to be a big deal. And it was only after a friend had was visiting me about 3 days before we were supposed to leave for Peru that I realized that I lost sight in one of my eyes. I think a lot of people, I think a lot of people would have kind of sounded the alarm bells at that point. But still, I was so stubborn in that moment where I just told myself,
ask you, what was the timeline? Like from the first moment where you realized that you were having breathing difficulties to the moment in which, like, you know, you had this like eyesight situation?
Absolutely. I think so. Probably the middle of February, I found myself going to work. I tend to be an early riser, work out in the morning, and try and get into work by around 8 a.m., but found myself unable to do that for whatever reason. And it was only after some friends visited about a month later, around March, the middle of March, that I found myself totally winded, having, you know, flu-like symptoms on a constant basis, fever symptoms. And then to the point where, you know, midway through a week, I couldn't see out of one of my eyes. I think I was telling myself at that time that they were very bad sinus headaches or very bad migraines. And it was only after the encouragement of my current fiance that, you know, you ought to go get that checked out, that I actually made an appointment for myself. And I remember walking into the nurse practitioner's office that day. I didn't care what kind of, you know, caretaker that I was seeing that day. I just needed to get a clinician to get me checked out.
Sure.
And in that moment, when I was, you know, reciting to her all of my symptoms in a really clinical and kind of dispassionate way, she stopped me and said, "Wait a second, this is the worst headache you've experienced in your life. You can't see out of the point of your eyes." And I was like, "Yeah, that's right." She said, "Yeah, I'm going to recommend that you go to the emergency room right away." And I was kind of taken back about that, because, again, going back to the fact that we've always experienced good health, that we've
expecting it,
kind of,
right? Yeah.
Exactly. You never think that that's going to happen to you, of course. So checked myself into the emergency room, and sure enough, found that I was totally pancytopenic, which means that every single one of my blood cell lines was vastly below normal levels. And it was in that moment where doctors and emergency room physicians, and then later residents and attendings were kind of able to be near my care and let me know that there was something more serious happening here. And in that first week was very difficult, not only because I was potentially dealing with a new diagnosis, but that diagnosis had also led to an infectious event where my doctors aren't quite sure, but suspect that I might have had bacterial meningitis. So had almost 2 days of an infectious event where I was totally out. Very thankful to have, you know, antibiotics at the bedside almost immediately when I needed them to take me out of septic shock. But in those first 4 days or so happened really quickly. Going from having a normal lifestyle to all of a sudden being diagnosed, being told by doctors.
The emergency room and
and being told that I've got this diagnosis of aplastic anemia, which is a very, very rare disorder. And in my case, and in many cases, is idiopathic, which means that they're not quite sure what the cause is of the event. So shortly after that, I was transferred from George Washington, where I was staying during my first week, to Johns Hopkins, which has a really great
medical program,
oncology and hematology group, and a great integrated care coordination to ensure that I can get a bone marrow transplant, which is the standard of care treatment for an event like this. And after that, started radiation, chemotherapy, followed by the really difficult task of identifying a bone marrow transplant donor within my family. We found that my father was a good fit, and he volunteered to give his bone marrow to me. And during that 3 month course of treatment, really feeling the having so many realizations during that course of that, because not only coming from it from this very clinical perspective, coming from my healthcare background, but also experiencing it personally, was a really emotional time for all of us. That was pretty difficult.
It strikes me as something that, I mean, in terms of, you know, you being at this amazing point in your career, preparing for this amazing trip that's up ahead, with no history of any kind of diagnosis as such, finding yourself in a position like this, in which it's trying, it's difficult, yet you are a healthcare professional yourself, and in those situations, in terms of all this difficulty you're going through and realizing the difficulties in the system, what was going through your head at that time? Like, were you thinking about all these deeper questions, or were you just focusing on recovery?
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting that you bring that up, because, you know, I'm going through this experience of a bone marrow transplant, and I'm also thinking about some of the amazing biomedical research that's happening right now and seeing around me. Actually, at the very moment that I was in the hospital was also when the Food and Drug Administration had first approved a CAR T therapy, which is a new cell therapy, gene therapy, to treat a type of leukemia. So the first time that scientists were able to approve a medicine for use in patients of basically inserting a new gene to cure them of or to give them long lasting therapy in that disease state. When I saw those events occurring around me, the first thought I had was, wow, like, particularly because I didn't just go through one bone marrow transplant, I actually ended up going through two. Yeah. I thought to myself, what is the value proposition to me for, instead of having to go through a very long preparatory regimen followed by, you know, weeks of immunosuppression and other therapy to ensure that my transplant has longevity? What would be the value proposition of having a gene therapy injected in order to cure? Obviously, this disease state is not necessarily amenable to that kind of treatment. But of course, that was a relevant.
You're considering all possibilities. Yes,
exactly. Yeah. And that's where questions of access to care really come in, I think, because as gene therapies and new innovative therapies are available for patients, because of the costs that are involved, and not just the cost, but also the infrastructure that's involved to administer a therapy that's very, very, that needs to be taken care of, that doesn't necessarily have a solid cold chain supply to the developing world.
Yeah.
We have to think about who's going to be able to get these medicines, who are they able to afford these medicines, who's able to be in the right setting to get these medicines delivered to them by high quality professionals.
Sure.
Those were some of the thoughts that I was experiencing in my own mind. On the flip side, something I was understanding is that despite the difficulty in access for a lot of patients, hospital systems, as much shit as that they get sometimes,
yeah.
are able to, when patients are able to access them, are really able to provide some really high quality
sure,
care. And,
sure.
and I saw that through my own diagnosis and my own treatment. The program at Johns Hopkins had a really unique situation where they had where patients were inpatient, and if you weren't undergoing an infectious event, and if you weren't at risk for a really big infectious event, you could actually stay in an apartment or some sort of complex off the hospital site and make sure that you were in the hospital for at least 12, 13 hours a day to receive your treatment. So, you know, compared to the average patient, and because my parents were able to afford me that luxury, I was able to actually stay in an apartment right off of the campus and then walk into the clinic every single day to receive my treatment. And I saw many such patients, not only from the D.C., Maryland, Virginia area, but from all over the Eastern Seaboard that were there, that were hematology and oncology patients that were receiving the kind of care that I was. Among those were patients that I would never have ever crossed paths with were not for the predicament I was in. I recall really fondly one patient who was a pastor from West Virginia.
Okay.
And not someone I would have crossed paths with were not for this event, but he and his wife were in clinic every single day and would often sit next to me when we were both undergoing our chemotherapy infusions.
Wow.
And our anti-infective infusions, and oftentimes when there was a particularly painful day, he and his wife would hold hands with me and recite a prayer. And although I wasn't necessarily religious, it didn't matter to me. It was
a gesture that mattered. And, yeah.
Absolutely. It gave me hope. I discussed some of the most personal facets of my life and some of the deepest and darkest thoughts I had had during my hospitalization with these people. And it was a very kind of unifying experience for patients that were, again, able to access this level of care.
Right. And I just actually want to take a step back. And I love how, I mean, while you narrate your story, you know, you seem like somebody that's gone through this experience, but has taken the best out of these experiences. But at the same time, I don't want to like move on from this whole episode without recognizing how serious it was. And I remember reading your article, and I think this one part that like really captured my attention was when you mentioned that a cold could have killed you during that time. And yet, you know, you look at yourself as a success story, and at the same time, you did have a relapse. You did have that second bone marrow transplant. What's going through your mind at this time? Because it is something so serious. You're still writing an article about this experience at the same time. Looking beyond yourself, you're thinking about others. You're thinking about everybody else that's, you know, going through the same system that you are. But what's going through Anirudh's head? What's happening in your mind with your family, with your now fiance, with your friends? That's something that I'm really curious about.
Absolutely. I think that, I was so lucky during both of my hospital stays, both before and after my relapse, to have the support of my family and friends at my side throughout that entire experience. Yeah. But despite that, a hospitalization can be an incredibly lonely experience, a very isolating experience for weeks on end. And that was a really tough occurrence. And when I was, you know, after my hospitalization in March and leaving Johns Hopkins in June, I was itching to get back into Washington, get back to work, be a productive citizen again, and find some sense of normalcy. And I was able to do that through the months of June and July in 2017. Although I was significantly weaker and thinner, and as my immune system was still very fragile,
sure.
I was taking all sorts of precautions. I had to be very careful. I couldn't live as robust a lifestyle as I had had prior to my hospitalization. But I was making great progress, and I was happy to be a productive member of society again. And all of a sudden, at the end of July, having that come to a screeching halt and realizing that my transplant had failed me and that I was going to be relapsing again, and that the only way for me to find normalcy again was to then go through another bone marrow transplant, was absolutely soul crushing. I remember that weekend where I had gone, I'd felt those same headaches come back again. My oncologist with whom I have an incredible close relationship with, had advised me to go get some blood tests done, and and see an email from her describing to me that she was actually really worried about my my blood cell levels, and following that, having a really good friend drive me up to the hospital to then understand my fate was pretty crushing. It was crushing not because I knew that I had the fortitude and the mettle to overcome a similar circumstance, but I thought about the effect it would have on my family, who had been so relieved to see me finally get over this huge hump. I thought about my friends who would have to relive some of these same experiences again, and I thought about myself and not being able to, and putting another hitting the pause button again on my life, on my advancements that I had made since then. And it was because of this kind of like stubbornness that I had, and this willingness to just overcome this experience again, that I kind of went to my employer and said, you know, this time I'm not taking time off. Give me my laptop. I'm really working from the hospital bed.
Yeah.
And I actually recall, funnily enough, having some conversations and conference calls with clients while my infusion pump was beeping because there was an occlusion in my line. And a client asked me, is there something wrong? Or is someone at the hospital? Like,
oh, my God. Wow.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't say this to kind of, not everyone has the luxury of doing it.
Sure,
right?
Sure.
Not
sure.
Everyone is able to be as cognizant through their care. But for me, it was a coping mechanism. Mm. It was a way of telling myself, look, like, through all these trying circumstances, I need to have something that's normal in my life. And part of that is having our weekly call with the client to give them a rundown on the federal policy landscape for biopharmaceutical companies. That was my sense. That was my semblance of kind of realism, and it injected a kind of hope and willingness to move on from it.
Sure. And so, from start to finish, how long did this entire process take, including your the second bone marrow transplant, and your subsequent recovery time, obviously?
Sure. So, diagnosed and hospitalized in the middle of March, finished my first course of treatment in the middle of June. Mm-hmm. Came home for about a month and a half, and during that time, I'm still doing weekly trips to Johns Hopkins to either receive other sorts of types of medicine or just get checkups from an oncologist.
Right.
And then relapsing in August and staying through that course of treatment through the end of November. And after that, again, continue to go to Johns Hopkins. And the way that I look at it, I'm still taking a lot of precautions, and my care isn't necessarily complete because a bone marrow transplant actually kind of wipes your immune system. So you start anew,
as if you were
a neonatal. Wow. And so because of that, I'm actually receiving a lot of the same vaccines that a lot of other people have when they're first born, through their first couple of years of infancy. And so still receiving those vaccinations and still kind of still on the road to recovery, but obviously doing a lot better. My hair's back. My strength is back.
Yeah.
My willingness to work day to day is back. And I left that experience doubling down efforts in healthcare and biopharmaceutical life sciences as well.
Awesome. I just, before we move on to our next course of discussions on this podcast, I just want to mention the kind of strength it takes to go through this entire process. And I know, you know, you're somebody who would like to brush it under the rug and talk about, you know, like how, I mean, come on, you were working while going through this entire experience. I just want to say that it's absolutely inspirational, and it probably gives a lot of people listening to this episode a lot of hope, in which, you know, all of us are dealing with something or the other. But to hear from you this incredible experience that you had to go through, but at the same time noticing and realizing that your optimism did not take a beating during the process, and at the same time it was your strength and passion and everything that just led you to where you are right now. So thank you for that. You don't have to respond to it. We'll move on to what I think.
Absolutely.
Is,
thank you, man.
Yeah, no worries, brother. What I want to move on to is, now you're entering back into this field that, you know, you were a part of, that you studied about and you immersed your life's work in. But I'm assuming that having been a patient and gone through this experience should have or may have opened your eyes to what it means to be on the other side. What was your experience like after, and what did it make you realize about the system that everyone is a part of in the United States?
I think first and foremost, one of my learnings was really about payment. And affordability and access. I think kind of a trope that you see a lot of, particularly on health policy Twitter, is time and time again, academicians and healthcare professionals that work, you know, that are doctors or nurses or other caregivers, often find that despite having a very intricate knowledge of the healthcare system and working in that system day in, day out, in hospitals or otherwise, they often find that when they themselves or people close to them are afflicted with medical emergencies or chronic conditions, that the billing process somehow becomes totally alien to them. It's not easy to navigate the billing and payment system in healthcare, even for people that are imbued in the system part of it. And that's pretty confounding, I think. I oftentimes would get bills from the hospital or outpatient clinics and scratch my head and say, why am I getting charged for this? And have to negotiate long-term over the phone with insurers and coordinate with pharmacies. And my takeaway from that is, if someone like myself who has, you know, a decent understanding of the healthcare value chain and the network of wholesalers and pharmacies, payers and hospitals that are kind of part of the system, and I still have struggle navigating this payment and this care, what is that like for someone that doesn't have that background, that doesn't have that prior knowledge? And I think, you know, a lot of people have made the joke, as our president glibly put, that healthcare is complicated, and it's one of those things where it's very easy to laugh at, but indeed it is pretty complicated. If someone that's a caregiver themselves can't understand how to navigate the experience, then it says a lot about it, I think.
Wow. What was the cost like, and did I guess here's my question, right? Like, I think if someone of your caliber and your background can't understand the system and can't navigate it, you know, based on prior knowledge, like, who is this system helping? And what does it say about the current status of healthcare in America?
Yeah, I mean, I think that one of the biggest problems that we have in our current healthcare system is a lack of transparency. I think there's a lot of great new policies and new efforts to focus on value in healthcare, and I think that pretty much anyone you would ask for is on board with that, right?
Yeah.
We don't want to pay for singular procedures and singular medical efforts. Rather, we want to pay long-term for what the value is that provides to the patient. And there have been a lot of efforts to try and get that done, including accountable care organizations, which, you know, about a decade ago, a lot of people in healthcare would have said, you know, bingo, this is the track that we should be on. And what we're finding is a couple things. One, we're finding that those aren't delivering delivering the savings to the healthcare system at large that we had once expected. And two, part of the reason might be that there's still a lack of transparency in what those costs are going towards, because we have a competitive healthcare system, the incentives are not aligned for hospitals and payers to reveal the true costs of healthcare to one another. And instead of patients are behind a wall, what we often pay for are parts of healthcare that aren't necessarily even related to the true costs, right? Because you're out of pocket costs and co-payments are sometimes totally removed from the true list price or the true cost of care. That experience kind of blinds us to what it is that we're actually paying on both sides. Sometimes it can devalue the amount, the procedure or the medicine that we're trying to get. This happens in antibiotics and antivirals a lot. We're paying much less than we should be paying for, sure. for those such drugs. And on the other end, it kind of it does the opposite, where we're you see, for example, insulin is a hot topic right now, where although there's been no innovation made in the diabetes field due to a lack of investment over the past 15 years, we have seen companies try to make up for that lack of innovation by raising prices on insulin incrementally and charging more. And so oftentimes, because of the lack of transparency in the system, we're dealing with this.
So, I mean, you're 25 years old, you're going through this incredibly life-altering, life-changing experience, but at the same time, you know, you're realizing all these different things about the system that you're a part of. And in terms of your career and your future trajectory and what you want to do in life, does that change your outlook? Does that give you a sense of, like, this is where I want to take my life's work, and this is what I want to be standing up for, voting people in for these kind of causes? Anything along
Absolutely.
Those lines?
I think if anything, it kind of made me double down my effort in this field. I'd always been attracted to life sciences, and growing up as the son of two biopharmaceutical chemists,
yeah.
I'd always had an attraction to the lab. My earliest memories are of my dad taking me to work at the biopharmaceutical company that he started at in San Diego, and watching him start reactions, chemical reactions, and use cool robots to do analytic work on the
That's
experiments
so cool.
that he was running. and those experiences and our dinner table conversations about the industry really shaped my own worldview. One of the things that my parents were proudest of were working on projects and working on experiments that were one day had the potential to alleviate pain and cure diseases. My father, for example, was proudest of his work at Arizona State as a working at their Cancer Research Institute, which was one of the nascent cancer research institutes at the time, in the late 80s and early 90s. And that imbued in me a sense of science, not for the sake of science, but rather to alleviate pain and cure disease. So that's something I carried into me through college. But in college, I began to take a more long run view of the healthcare system.
Yeah.
And while I had a passion for bench science, I kind of took the view that working on policy and working on kind of higher level decision making could influence the investment that we put into the biopharmaceutical
sure.
field, the access to care that people of all backgrounds can reach, and the potential that can have not just in here in the United States but across the world.
Amazing. And so you're a student at the University of California at Berkeley, if I'm not mistaken, right? And
that's right.
Yeah, and you're already thinking all these thoughts. You're thinking about this long term, you know, path that you might take to affect change in the lives of all these people. So young Anirudh, right about to graduate, what are you thinking in terms of a career choice, and what do you end up doing?
Yeah, I mean, I think I reflecting back on my college self, I think that I was really torn. I had a lot of different ways I wanted to go. I knew that I'd come into Berkeley majoring in chemistry and having that passion for the life sciences. But it was also a campus that at the time was undergoing a lot of changes. I witnessed the kind of the beauty of civic action.
Amazing.
I was there during some of the Occupy protests and saw what students who really cared about dismantling and kind of revolutionizing the system could do for them on a day-to-day yeah. basis. And
systemic injustice in general, I guess.
Absolutely,
right? Yeah.
Absolutely. And I think that was really crystallized for me in a course that I took with Professor Robert Reich, who now famously on social media is really become a political interlocutor, but at the time was a professor that really imbued in me a sense of hope and policy. In the context of his course, often those things, as you would expect, were in the context of inequality mm-hmm. and the wealth gap and stagnation in wages. And it was in that class that I saw through the scope of wealth inequality that the impact that federal policy could make on the lives of individuals.
Mm.
So while the wealth inequality aspect was only one of the parts of his course. It was the aspect that kind of most impacted me, because I basically took that and projected it onto healthcare, an area where there is tons of inequality.
Right.
And so when I was winding down at college, I kind of had a few different paths to pursue. Many of my peers in chemistry were pursuing graduate school studies, where they were going to be focusing on a really niche aspect of organic chemistry or inorganic chemistry, and studying really like robust mechanisms and finding new applications to their science. I, however, had been very highly influenced by my coursework in public policy and low poverty. I had a penchant for politics. I had watched enough of The West Wing
to
idealize the life in Washington. Right. So a number of these factors kind of made me ponder, you know, what I was going to do after college.
Hmm.
I had gone down the tried and true path of interviewing at some biopharmaceutical companies after having interned at so many during my course in college, and was kind of caught between two options of staying in the Bay Area and becoming a research scientist at a biopharmaceutical company, which was doing some really great work, or to wholesale try something new, move to Washington and forge a path in a career that I didn't necessarily have the technical know-how and background in, but did have the passion and scientific background to apply to healthcare. So it was that decision that found me in the freshman Congressman Scott Peters' office as an intern. Doing pretty much anything to help out the office, you know, pulling staff members in that office and others aside to kind of ask them about the legislative process.
Sure.
Did a lot of my own homework to understand how federal policymaking gets done, and shortly thereafter landing at a life sciences government relations firm and finding mentorship under some colleagues that had forged new pathways in terms of research and development policy in the United States.
Amazing. I just want to, again, focus in on the internship experience in the House of Representatives that you had, because I draw parallels with my experience being an intern at the Senate. What was that initial, like, I mean, given that you didn't come in from like a policy or a politics background, and finding yourself at the heart of this beast, right? Like in Washington, D.C., at the Capitol. What were some of your initial observations about how policy functioned, who was making policies, and the role of these representatives and senators that were elected in government? I know this is a provocative question, because I have strong opinions on these too, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on your initial days right there.
Absolutely. You know, for me, I entered that internship really nervously. I had just taken a big decision to leave a well-paying job in the biopharmaceutical sector to take an unpaid internship in Congress. And it was a huge gamble, and I was unsure about my career path. And almost every day I would wake up questioning whether or not this passion for civic service was gonna pan out, and this passion for policy was gonna forge a career for me. But the moment that I stepped into the halls of Congress and was able to interact with individuals that I respected and spent my entire childhood looking up to, all of that kind of washed away.
Right.
I was totally just taken aback. I remember doing kind of small tasks to help the office out, whether it was typing up a constituent letter or a congressional letter and delivering it to another office in support of a piece of legislation that Congressman Peters was supporting at that time. I would cherish the task of writing a letter out and putting in a letterhead and putting it in an envelope and then getting, you know, 15 to 20 minutes to walk all the way to the hall of Congress from the House side all the way to the Senate side through those underground chambers and tunnels and finding my way, sometimes sneaking into the halls when you're next to the Speaker's office to get a peek inside. Those are really exciting times for me, and also fairly tenuous times in Congress. It was during the Ted Cruz shutdown of 2013. It was just days after the president had decided at the time that Congress should take the a key decision on an airstrike in Syria. Those were very tenuous times and really kind of a trial by fire for a new intern like me, who was manning the telephone for that time, fielding constituent calls and concerns. And I always perhaps on questions of healthcare when it came to the Affordable Care Act, which was at the center of the
debates and discussions
shutdown
time,
at that time. I often was perhaps punching a little bit above my pay grade by fielding constituent calls and opining my own, on myself on right. what the
responsibility what the to defend was. The congressman. Yeah.
Correct. And then sometimes getting chided privately by staff members who would advise me that, you know, my job wasn't necessarily to articulate the congressman's thinking on the matter, but rather to just to take down their own concerns. So I was like, okay, all right. But, you know, those experiences kind of showed me that I had a broader appetite, that I was developing a skill at the time of getting my teeth cut and in the legislative process. And it was a career that I was going to pursue. And looking back now and knowing how much I know about this field and being able to advise my own colleagues in my current job and dogs before this on matters of federal policymaking, I think back to myself and, wow, I can't believe that I'm in this position now.
Yeah, and I think it, like, in the long term, at least, it paid off to be a very wise decision to go and take that opportunity over your other pharma gig that you had lined up. Let's talk about, like, the next couple of years. You know, you're, like, cutting your teeth, being this young professional in Washington, D.C. What was it like? What were you doing during that time frame? Let's just talk about that time frame, because I think around then is when I met you as well.
That's right. So my first really robust professional experience in Washington started in January of 2014 when I joined a really small boutique government relations firm called the Conifay Group, mm-hmm. and under the guidance of a veteran of biopharmaceutical policy making named Stephen Conifay. It was in that job that I really found a niche for myself, realized what I was good at, and took a big stride forward in what I was doing. The issues that I was working on there were primarily around issues of antimicrobial policy. As I had mentioned before, of all the talk today about drug pricing and high prices in new innovative therapies, one area that's immune to this conversation is the anti-infectives. Mm. Every day you see new articles about antimicrobials or microbial superbugs and diseases, infectious diseases that are that require acute care, but sometimes can have devastating impacts on patients because of issues of poor stewardship of antibiotics in the past, which lead to resistance of some of these bugs, evolving bugs for which we do not currently have cures.
Yeah,
and because these drugs are administered in acute care, which means that you can't take them for a long period of time for chronic care, and because historically they've been available very cheaply for the health system and for patients, we've seen a lack of new investment in that field, and a lack of policy making to keep up to ensure that new developers are making new anti-infectives to treat the preeminent threat of superbugs. So it was in that time that I discovered, you know, how the federal government can use its power to incentivize drug developers to take on these new projects, while also ensuring that there's a robust regulatory standard to ensure that prescribers and physicians are only prescribing anti-infectives when they're needed.
There's a requirement for
what they call the right drug for the right bug. Mm. So not abusing the drug, but only using when it's necessary. So it was during that time that I worked on legislation to ensure that there was a robust regulatory pathway for some of these new drugs to be new drugs to come to market. For during that time, where I discovered that there's financial pull incentives and other ways that the government can kind of spark investors to go and invest money into biopharmaceutical companies which saw pathways for antibiotics and antivirals and antifungals. And that was my first time, you know, taking these kind of complicated scientific scientific realities and these complicated kind of healthcare realities, yeah, and condensing them into small talking points executives at these companies to go in front of Senate offices and congressional offices and describe passionately to members of the Congress why it was that we need new investments there. And it's something that I personally felt as well, because yeah, when I was undergoing my own infectious disease offense, I understood how important it is to get you know, antibiotics into me as quickly as possible to fight off infections, and something that's really relevant to me as well.
Amazing. The way you describe so passionately the work that goes behind the scenes, right? Like, because it's not in the work of somebody in your role at that time who forms that essential bridge between the government as well as the CEOs and the leaders of all these drug companies. It's so crucial, yet it's not talked about, because it's the packaging that matters, right? Because we know from right, our experience working in the government that the senators and representatives have so many things on their plate that the things that capture their attention need to be packaged in the most effective manner so that it's so digestible, but it also raises the flags that need to be raised within the senator to get their team to be working on those issues that need to be working on. Any particular experiences that you went through during those few years where you were working in this arena that kind of opened your eyes towards the most effective way to get the word across to a senator or a representative or something along those lines?
Absolutely. I think that the most impactful and most the kind of the points that resonated most with policymakers was all about impact on patients. Mm. I think that when you were able to go into an office and describe to a staff member, describe to a member why this policy is important and why this issue is important, it was always about drawing a line between that policy and the eventual impact on patients.
Sure.
I think a lot of the times, especially when we're talking about healthcare, we're getting lost in the clouds on conversations about saving costs, about delivering value. Mm. But what does that mean to an individual? What are the individual stories that drive that conversation? It's patients like me. It's patients like people that live in those people's districts.
Yeah, exactly.
It's
exactly,
individual stories that really are what healthcare is about. And I think that kind of draws at something larger about, you know, we're coming off of this 2018 midterm election where the Democrats were able to win a lot of seats because they were able to tell a unifying story about healthcare.
Mm.
And this is not unique, right? Time after time, we've seen that healthcare resonates with voters. Why is that? Is it because they're also worried about conversations about saving costs, about transformation of value-based care from fee-for-service? No, it's because it matters to them as individuals.
Right. It's something that everyone's going through.
Personally.
Yeah.
Exactly. Mm. So it's not these kind of lofty conversations about how are we going to, control the rising cost of drugs? How are we going to ensure that there's the right investment for the right types of therapies and medicines? It's really, what's going to save you? What's going to make sure that your mom and dad live longer? And those are the conversations that's what voters are ultimately thinking about. And that's what resonated most in my experiences in Washington as well.
Amazing. I've recently watched way too many Netflix and other documentaries on healthcare. And right, it's all, like, a lot of the focus is on pharma companies and other companies that are quote unquote working to try and innovate in this space. What do you see are the biggest challenges to kind of getting this entire industry cleaned up? Because the stories of pharma companies just hiking prices, buying up other pharma companies to increase the overall value of their company and not investing in research and development is rampant. There are stories and more, like, at least as a lay consumer, for me, that is alarming to hear. With somebody with a lot more expertise and understanding of the arena, can you tell us a little more about it?
Yeah, I think there certainly have been a lot more cases that we've been seeing of bad actors in this field that aren't doing the good work of innovating new drugs. They're not bringing new drugs for underserved populations. They're not meeting unmet medical need.
Yeah.
Instead, they're taking old drugs and driving up those prices and cornering markets and making it impossible for patients that need those life-saving drugs to be able to access them in an expeditious way. And you know, certainly there's a lot of such bad actors, and I think the solution there is to ensure that there's competition in the marketplace to ensure that can happen.
Yeah.
But I think more broadly, what I'm heartened to see and what I'm hopeful to see is that we see more and more such companies that are coming out with really innovative new drugs, talking more about not just the manufacturing costs and talking about what price they can price this drug at the market will bear, but instead having a conversation about the outcomes that those medicines will eventually have on patients, the value that drug brings to the healthcare system at large, which should then be tied to the price of this new medicine.
Yeah,
now,
yeah.
What I'm saying is a much easier said than done, but some of the more heartening examples, and I think the right-headed examples that we've seen so far, are companies that are innovating some very costly new drugs and saying that, the price of this drug, the value of this drug, is going to be tied to the impact that it has on you, the patient. This drug is priced at, however many hundreds of thousands of dollars, but you're going to get, and your payer is going to help administer to you diagnostic tests at various milestones through your care to ensure that that drug is continuing to be efficacious to you, and it's continuing to give you, in what healthcare economics they'll call quality adjusted life years. There, it's continuing to add to your life in a meaningful way. And if it's not, we're going to significantly discount this drug, or we're going to give it to you for free. There's a number of barriers to doing this. One, a lot of insurers and payers have to get on board for this. Now, we've only seen a small sliver of companies do this to some extent today. And another is a fairly, frankly, the financial or the administrative burden of this, right? So we can do this kind of utilization management, as they call it. We can do this on a very small scale for a small number of patients that are being treated with a gene therapy, for example. And because at that point, it's very easy to go through those diagnostic tests and understand, what value is this creating for patients. But think about drug population or patient populations where there's, thousands and thousands of patients and payers that are responsible for all these beneficiaries. Are they going to be able to do this in a timely fashion? Are they going to be able to ensure that the right value price is being delivered to each of those patients? Maybe not. So that's something that we need to think about and consider as well.
So, I mean, basically right now, the system that's in place is or in place more widely than this value-based healthcare system that you're talking about is the fee-for-service the system in which the providers are paid for based on the amount of healthcare services that they provide, correct? And so,
right.
I'm trying to understand what incentivizes this system to move on to a value-based one when, providers can essentially make a lot of money by, continually spending or writing more medicines or like treating the patients on a longer-term basis. I'm having a little bit of difficulty finding what could incentivize providers to want to move to a value-based system.
It's a great question, and it's one that's kind of continuing to stump our current healthcare system, I think. So one of the answers to that question is that we want to kind of drive cost tied to quality, not quantity, right?
Yeah.
So for example, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services constantly comes up with new demonstration projects to have providers and physicians tie their payments to the ultimate outcome that the patient experiences.
Sure.
And so you've seen a lot of such efforts as bundled care. So instead of getting billed for every single procedure that's occurring, you get one unified bill, or the government gets one unified bill for the entire continuum of care that a patient experiences.
Sure.
And the quality of that care will result in a higher payment than one that doesn't give the outcomes that's necessary. However, as I talk to my friends, my own friends that are physicians that treat in areas where there's a lot of barriers to quality care, that kind of helps me understand, what the roadblocks are that, that still exist. For example, I was talking to a friend earlier who was talking about a CMS demonstration project, which ties the ultimate payment to the how quickly, for example, a patient is treated with an anti-infective, even if you haven't necessarily identified the pathogen, or how quickly can we get the patient out of the inpatient care and ensure that they are not readmitted to hospitalization. Now, in areas where there's overall better population health, that's easy. That's fairly easy to do.
Sure.
However, in patient populations where there's a number of hurdles for access to care, for example, being able to get to appointments on time, being able to have good quality adherence to your medication, those things are more difficult. So, or should providers and physicians payments and should their alignment of incentives factor in the fact that certain patient populations are more difficult to treat than others? This is something that kind of still plagues the conversation around value-based care, because we can't have a model that's one size fits all. Hospitals that are treating patient populations where, you know, upwards of 95% of the patients are on Medicare or Medicaid are going to have significantly more trouble getting high quality outcomes on a regular basis than places that are not. For example, in my care at Johns Hopkins, for example.
Interesting. So what could essentially incentivize the move to more value-based healthcare? Because I see how it benefits every actor involved or every stakeholder, for instance.
Right.
But at the same time, the cost of change is incredibly high because it's a system that's been in place for so long. Essentially, in your opinion, what could incentivize such a move at the fastest trajectory possible? What could make this actually a reality?
I that's a tough question. I don't think I have the silver bullet answer to it, but I think that it's a lot of different things. I think that for example, just within accountable care organizations, one of the barriers has been that physicians and providers haven't necessarily been on board. They're getting paid to do less, not more. They're getting paid less to do more.
Yeah.
So that's been a really, really difficult burden. I think that eventually we have to ensure that providers are kind of on the same page, that incentives are aligned. We have to kind of ensure that there's more accountability and transparency in these systems to ensure that, you know, the optimal kind of condition is being met. I don't know. It's really hard, but I think that ultimately it comes down to aligning incentives for all the stakeholders.
That's valid. In terms of where healthcare in America is at the moment, and I know this is a very broad, very generic question, but it's something that has stumped, like, I think, me for the longest time. In terms of, you know, universal healthcare is a concept that exists in so many other countries and is being experimented with. Yet there is this big resistance in the United States. There are a lot of debates and discussions on what form it could look like, how it would impact different stakeholders, how it would impact different people. Where is, like, if you could give broadly, like, what is America's healthcare situation looking like right now? And also, what do you think is the utopian dream that the system can get to? I know it's a loaded question.
that's a good question. I'll kind of take a look at it from the scope of the biopharmaceutical industry and its impact on the U.S. healthcare system, and talk about it from that perspective. I think one of the hurdles to achieving the kind of utopian dream that we have for American healthcare is that we're accustomed to a type of care that's pretty unique, right? Because in our current government healthcare system, so Medicare and Medicaid, Medicare doesn't have the ability to negotiate with biopharmaceutical companies. So ultimately, what that means is that despite the fact that the government gets the drugs at a significant discount from what other payers might be paying, most every drug is able to get onto government formularies. So once they've been approved through FDA and once the negotiations have been completed, we're able to get access to a number of innovative drugs in our US healthcare system. Elsewhere, for example, in the UK, you have a system called NICE. And NICE is the, let me look this up actually.
I like the name already.
NICE, yeah, NICE, it's a National Institute for Health and Care Excellence.
Okay.
And what NICE does is that they're able to go act as the chief negotiator on behalf of the UK health population with the biopharmaceutical company. And if the value proposition of a drug does not meet the high standards that NICE has for their cost per quality adjusted life year measurement, if that drug does not provide the value that they believe that this drug should be providing at a particular cost point, NICE will walk away from the table and say, our population doesn't have access to this drug.
I see.
Now, that's a significant trade-off that the United States has to consider and think about. Is that something that we're willing to do in our healthcare system? Are we going to say no to some of our patients because we don't believe that the drug that we're considering for inclusion here has the value proposition that we believe that it should? That we're not getting our best bang for a buck.
Yeah.
Other countries have said, yes, that is something that we're willing to take on. That's something that we'll take the mantle on. And in those cases that you have some fringe cases where patients will travel to other countries to try and access new medicines,
right,
or some patients are being left behind, particularly in the EU, where you have a case where larger countries like the UK or in Germany, Spain, Italy, and France are able to access medicines first, but many other smaller countries like on the fringes are not able to get access right away because they're being left behind and because their payers take longer to perform those negotiations. Universal healthcare does mean having some of those trade-offs. Right? So will there be savings to our healthcare system? Probably yes. But will everyone be able to get covered and have the quality healthcare that we need? Maybe not. So I think these are some of the trade-offs that need to be considered. I see plenty of viable options on both sides. Now, do we need are we for, you know, a universal healthcare system where everyone has access to healthcare? Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
Right now we do it through a mix of our public and private systems. I think that, you know, the Affordable Care Act has obviously made a lot of strides towards that. But now all of a sudden what you're seeing in the Democratic realm is that we're unsatisfied. Although that we've gotten a number of new people covered under this, we're not satisfied that the marketplace has been able to reach a sufficient number of people. We're not satisfied the government is able to take care of enough people now. We want that switch. In fact, I'm not sure that I know enough to say definitively whether we should be moving to one healthcare system or not. Although what I can say with certainty is that whatever path we choose, we are going to have pretty significant trade-offs in each.
Makes sense. Another thing that's really always on the top of my mind when I come, at least recently, I've read the book, I've watched the HBO documentary, and it revolves around Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes. It's this whole thing that is kind of captured my imagination, if I may. Marrying tech with innovation and trying to revolutionize. I think everyone's stuck in that, you know, disruption. Although we're starting to slowly move away from it and see the challenges to it. The terms disruption and, you know, kind of revolutionizing industries has kind of taken over most people's imaginations. And it has led to what I would say very dangerous situations like what Theranos was doing. Do you see in your day-to-day work that that now perhaps after all the coverage on this Theranos situation that there is this a little bit of, like, it's kind of like a cautionary tale that there's a little bit of a hesitation when it comes to wanting to be the first to do this crazy innovation? Or is it still in that phase at the moment?
That's a good question. I think even before the Theranos story, investors that are savvy in biopharmaceutical sector and in healthcare, investors that are truly savvy, have a pretty high bullshit detector. I think that most investors are savvy enough to look at it just from the perspective of life sciences, look at a particular technology or look at a particular potential experimental therapy and think about what's come before that. What are the mechanisms of action that we've been able to invest in that have come to market and been fruitful? What are the kind of disease areas that we've been able to tackle before that have a viable path?
Yeah.
And we see also that I don't think that Theranos should prove to be a cautionary tale about the role that technology empowering life sciences through like innovative technology should have at all on the field. In fact, I think that today in the biopharmaceutical sector, we're driving this asset selection of new therapies through artificial intelligence.
Amazing.
We're using new technologies to ensure that the best data is being culled from clinical trials to get products to market fastest. We're using technology, for example, to all sorts of different things that are being made fruitful in life sciences. I think the medical products or the medical device sector is a little bit different, but ultimately all of these therapies and all of these new technologies have to be held to the high gold standard of the Food and Drug Administration. And if it doesn't pass muster there, then consumers are going to be skeptical, providers and payers are going to be skeptical. And that's ultimately the final litmus test. You know? I think that a lot of investors and a lot of patients lost hope and money in the process of Theranos. But I remain confident that the vast majority of savvy investors have a pretty high bullshit detector when it comes to this kind of stuff.
So you would just say that Theranos was one that just slipped through the system rather than being potentially, one amongst many that are vying for this top spot?
I think that amongst new high-tech startup culture, it might be one of many. I think unique to healthcare, I tend to think that people have pretty high standard in healthcare and that it probably a one-off circumstance in healthcare.
Well, that's good to hear. And
that's just my opinion.
Right.
A lot of people disagree with me.
No, but I'm sure like given all the experience that you've accumulated in the industry that, you would know when there is bullshit, when somebody's offering something that's perhaps not really up to standard or up to mark.
Totally.
But moving on, just in terms of you as a healthcare professional, in terms of somebody who's very aware of and thinking about policy at all times, what's keeping you up at night in terms of this entire healthcare policy, juxtaposition?
I think what keeps me up at night is access to care. Mm. I think that we're getting better innovation in healthcare every single day. We're in a renewed age of biomedical innovation. I think there's something like 800 different experimental gene therapies in clinical trials today.
Wow,
that is amazing from a scientific perspective, and it should bring hope to lots of patients. But unfortunately, because we don't have everything figured out from a payment perspective and from an access perspective, that reality could still be a dream for many patients.
I see.
And so the thing that keeps me up at night is how can we ensure that all the great new technologies that are coming to the forefront in healthcare today are going to be accessible to patients not only here in the United States, but around the globe.
What other countries around the world are at the forefront of innovation when it comes to drugs and healthcare provision apart from the United States?
I think the sad reality is that the United States stands alone in the field of biomedical innovation as at the forefront. I think a lot of other countries have figured out a lot of other things. They've gotten processes right. For example, most of the clinical manufacturing occurs ex-US, and other countries have really fine-tuned the aspect of manufacturing and getting final products to patients. But in terms of the benchtop chemistry and the benchtop biology, that the best of that is still happening in the United States. The best of that is still funded by our National Institutes of Health, and the best of that is happening in our academic laboratories as well. U.S. is far and large the largest provider of biomedical innovation across the world, and it's one of the reasons that we also have some of the highest costs in the world as well.
That's amazing. I think ever since I've moved to India and kind of dabbled in the education space a little bit, I've realized that one of the biggest challenges, and correct me if I'm wrong, if this does not apply to the United States, is STEM education and drawing interest into the field. Because rote learning has kind of been the biggest challenge to its widespread adoption and spread in India. You know, you have people that are studying the sciences, eventually moving into the finance sectors or the consulting spaces, largely because it's not made interesting. It's dictated by textbooks, and it doesn't capture the imagination of the population. How is that different in the United States? Is there a challenge to STEM education? Is there a big barrier to entry, or is the education system kind of allowing for students to want to do that?
That's a good question. I think it all kind of comes down to the alignment of incentives. Mm-hmm. I think we need to do a better job ensuring that people from all backgrounds are excited about getting into STEM subjects, studying those in college, and knowing that there is a pathway for them to make a robust career out of that once they leave school. I think that's probably like the big bottleneck that we have, the rate limiting step for students to pursue careers in STEM after graduating from school, is to ensure that there's a market out there for you to be able to apply those skills in a way that's interesting, in a way that's productive to society, in a way that's financially sustainable.
Absolutely.
That's kind of what I see as the biggest bottleneck.
Very nice. I've been peppering all my American guests on this show about their thoughts on politics, and as it's my favorite subject, I think I'm going to turn it to you as well. What do you think about the current race? There are so many individuals that have thrown their hat in the upcoming American presidential elections, and some really big names, some people that I personally am really excited about. I want to know what you think, or if you choose not to answer this, I totally understand because it's still developing. But do you have a front runner for you already? Is there somebody that has captured your imagination and you're willing to go to war for?
You know, I haven't had that experience yet because I think I'm still holding out for one of the candidates to develop a plan and really articulate a singular policy on healthcare. I think that of all of the roster of the candidates that we've seen so far, many of them, and I think Elizabeth Warren obviously comes to mind, has been prolific in releasing different policy ideas and policy plans. I think a lot of our friends in the climate and energy field are so excited to see that many candidates are putting their plans on the record and really getting into the nitty-gritty, and they're not just it's not just rhetoric. What we're seeing from the analysis that I've seen is a robust plan that's very wonky as well, that gets into the nitty-gritty of the policy. We haven't seen that yet in healthcare. What we have seen is candidates say that they're behind Medicare for All, some that will say that they're for universal healthcare, but none of those
it doesn't reach the nuances of it, is it?
And so I'm still hungry to see, for example, in 2018, a lot of candidates went on the sales trail and said, my big vision is to make the Affordable Care Act even stronger, is to strengthen Obamacare. But again, that doesn't really get down to the nitty-gritty of what that means.
Yeah.
My ideal candidate is getting up on the stump and talking about why we need to shift to value-based care and why it matters that outcomes for patients are what we should be valuing. And that will really be the thing that will drive savings to the healthcare system and make your family feel safer and healthier. But none have done that so far. None of that articulated that. Many have talked about how important it is to have healthcare and have access, and those are all really important, but none have articulated a singular vision for how we're going to get that done. And obviously it's easier said than done. And you've heard me on this podcast kind of go in circles and pontificate about my ideas, but never give you anything concrete, because I feel the same way too, but I'm waiting for a candidate to do that.
Do you think part of the reason that candidates stray away from giving exact policy frameworks when it comes to healthcare is because it is such a complicated system that it is difficult for the lay person, the average voter, to understand? Because you've seen the wide success that Trump has had going around, absolutely not talking anything of substance, but just giving sound bites that somehow, you know, even though they sound idiotic to me, it is capturing the imagination because it is being communicated in a way that's effective. And I'll give him that. It's capturing the imagination of his voters. Do you think that if somebody gets up on their, you know, stump and starts talking about why value-based healthcare is much better for you than, you know, having, you know, more visits that lead to more payments for your providers, do you think it might drift away and move away from the topic? Or are you more optimistic about it?
I'm a little bit more optimistic. I think I would challenge the candidates to take on that task. I think that candidates are very comfortable doing that about the economy.
Yeah,
we've seen candidates get up on the stump and describe how investment in green energy will be new jobs for people, how job retraining will help drive our market towards that. We've seen that in a number of other fields. Why can't we do that in healthcare? Why can't we articulate something that is meaningful for voters that would describe to them articulately why this should matter to them? Why can't we see that in healthcare? We've seen the rote talking points of, we don't want this party or that party to take away healthcare from you. Those are meaningful. There's no doubt about it. But we can dig one level deeper and talk about those things in a way that's still meaningful for voters.
Absolutely. I mean, I couldn't agree more. I think that is a fair challenge to throw to our candidates, is to, like, why are we holding them at such a low standard, right? Like, we need to expect them to do more, be more, and, you know, essentially articulate what their plan for this new America is that they're going to take over whenever they get elected.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that said, what are you up to these days? Like, let's talk about work life. Let's talk about the personal life. What's happening? What are you most excited about? And what are your thoughts about your future? You know, what are you looking forward to?
Absolutely. So just executed a move to New York City just a few months ago, still filling out my new digs here, working at a really cool, innovative biopharmaceutical company here in Manhattan that's really working to serve some unmet medical needs.
Amazing.
And bring new therapies to patients that haven't been served before.
Wow.
And I'm really excited to do that from kind of a public affairs and policy perspective, where I'm able to do what I love best in this field, which is take kind of complicated scientific and healthcare-oriented talking points and distill them into things that are meaningful for the general public and for policymakers to digest and understand and communicate in and amongst themselves. That's what's driving me on a day-to-day basis here. The weather's getting nicer here in New York City, so I've been out trying to get some runs in, playing Central Park, live life to the fullest here in New York. And I think for me, it's really been every day I wake up is one day one further day in my recovery. I'm still finding and exploring my own bounds. I'm finding that every day I'm finding that I'm a little less limited than I was the day before, that I'm able to do something new, whether it's lift weights, go on a run, hang out until a really late time with some close friends. I'm still exploring those bounds for myself because of a pretty life altering experience. But New York is a great place to do it.
Oh, that sounds amazing, brother. Anything that you've read recently that's captured your imagination that you'd like to share with our audience?
Absolutely. I'm just putting finishing up Michelle Obama's book.
Dude, I want to get my hands on that comic, so bad.
it's a great book, and I've always been attracted to kind of political memoirs, but I think that this book is really unique. Struck me as really unique and a really beautiful story about an individual that's had so many life experiences distilled into one. And another book that I've read recently is Cass Sunstein's Nudge, which I'm sure a lot of econ geeks will have read as well. But a very fun read, which I recommend.
Behavioral economics at the heart of it. What Indeed. About music? Any song or a musical piece that has you inspired that you'd like to share?
You know, I used to be so much more involved in trying to read and listen to the newest music. I've kind of stopped doing that for whatever reason over the past few years. But an album released on Friday, which I definitely recommend to everyone, which is Vampire Weekend's new album. definitely a nostalgic listen to me for because that was a band that I used to listen to a lot in high school, and I kind of put aside. But now they've come out with some new music, which is pretty great, which I recommend to everyone.
That's amazing. Another big news in your life is that you recently got engaged. So
yes, I did.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, no, man. I mean, there's so many exciting things ahead of you. You've fought a big battle. You continue to fight that battle for everybody else, especially in the policy arena, trying to make healthcare more accessible to everybody. That's what's capturing your imagination. That's what you're thinking about.